Good evening, ladies and gentlemen and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to episode 39 on December 11th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
And we're your hosts, as usual. And Ray, I think we need to inform the listeners tonight that this, don't jump to conclusions, listeners, but this is our last program for 2014. Table Talk will be taking 2 weeks off for Christmas, and will return on January 1st, 2015. So, isn't that right, Ray?
I guess that's the way it is. You betcha.
Yeah, well, I decided that 2 weeks is fine with me. I know it might seem like too much to some people, but I need a good long Christmas break, so that's not too much, because of the way Christmas is falling. So we can't do a program on the 18th, and we don't want to do one on the next time. So, but we will have one on New Year's night, New Year's Day night, on the 1st. So, and you know, Ray, as you were telling me, you don't think we're very far from the end of this wonderful series.
Yes, judging from the amount that we're covering each Thursday, Carolyn, I kind of calculated it out, and if we keep going at this pace, about maybe 14 more shows.
Aha, 14. Well, that's quite a few. I've somehow got translated that into about 8 or 9 after you told me that. So that's what I was remembering. So I thought, how many was that? And I had deleted the email, so I couldn't go back and check it. Well, that's still quite a ways to go. Yeah, that's quite a number of months yet. So we are not finished with this wonderful series. I was already starting to feel sad about it being over. Well, we have another really good bunch of material tonight, and it ends, I think we're going to end with a kind of a special event. I shouldn't maybe call it special, but especially tragic event, and which will maybe be a good ending point for our two-week hiatus over Christmas. So we'll see. I don't think we'll get further than that, or I don't even want to get further than that. So that is Hitler talking about Hitler's comments after the death of Reinhard Heydrich.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm hoping that we get that far and are able to cover that. So that's about where I figured we would get to.
Yeah, I think we will cover that, even if we're a little bit late doing so, because we can go over a little bit. So we don't have to worry about that. So let's go ahead and get started then. We're on May 20th, and I read the timeline for May 20th last week, so I don't have one for this first section.
Okay, and if I may say, this section, as has been demonstrated throughout our lessons and study of this book, demonstrate once more the amazing areas of knowledge that Adolf Hitler had about subjects that you would never thought he would have paid much attention to. But you'll understand what we mean as we get on into it. 20th of May, 1942, at dinner. Results of National Socialist policy. Effects of National Socialist education. Ignominious status of theater, artistes. Encouragement of prostitution. Since we took over power, we National Socialists have completed a vast number of tasks of which no mention whatever has been made in public. We wasted no breath, for example, in telling the world how tens of thousands of beings who, under the Weimar Republic, were forced to earn their living in most dubious ways, have now been given by us the chance of leading a decent existence. Of primary importance were the measures we took to ensure a living wage for working women, such as secretaries, shop girls, artistes, and the like. By insisting that they receive a regular wage in accordance with their qualifications, instead of the sort of pocket money they formerly received, we have delivered them from the doleful necessity of being dependent on an ami for their existence. What formerly infuriated me more than anything else was the way in which dancers were treated. While so-called comedians, mostly Jews, earned 3 or 4,000 marks a month in theaters like the Berliner Metropole for 15 minutes of smut, the dancers were paid as little as 70 or 80 marks. And that, mind you, in return, not for 15 minutes, but if they were to keep themselves up to the mark, for practically a whole day's work of training, practice, and so on. Such discrepancies are contemptible. They left these poor creatures no alternative but to go on the streets and turn the theater into a euphemism for brothels. Without making any fuss about it, I made sure that the pay for these dancers was raised to 180 to 200 marks, and thus gave them the chance of devoting themselves entirely to their art. This also had considerable effect on the theater itself. Firstly, it allowed them to engage really good-looking girls for the stage. Secondly, it enabled the theater to retain them and train them in the further perfection of their art. And thirdly, it meant that the theater could foster their general education and thus fit them at the latest at the stage of 35 or so to leave the stage, marry, and settle down.
Okay, interesting
thing about that to me, Carolyn, was I've studied a lot about World War One and the post-war period, the gap between 1918 and 1933, and the Weimar Republic, in other words. And that was an era characterized by strictly as you would have thought it would have been, by the government forced upon Germany by the Allies. That Weimar Republic, it was characterized pornography, prostitution, narcotics, all kinds of immorality and crimes were rampant under that Weimar regime, and nothing done about it. It's kind of like the USA today. Is a lot of places around the country are just like anarchy, and it was that kind of ridiculous garbage that made a lot of Germans look for an out, someone that would come along and help.
Of course, you know, the Jews had free reign at that time,
yes.
And this was all,
yes.
The Jews were behind all of this theater and what was going on in so the degeneracy in that was available everywhere. And these people, the German people, including young women, had no way of making a living, so many of them, and so they were at the mercy of this system.
Correct.
Although I do find it, and of course he was very observant of that, but they still want to have theater in Germany. I know that Hitler was all for theater, and that included even the lighter type of things. And of course in the movies that they made, they also made musicals. And musicals always have chorus lines, so there's plenty of chorus lines. So they needed all these girls. And if you looked close, sometimes, not so much in the movies, but they weren't so great looking. They didn't even have such great legs sometimes. But they could kick their legs up and so on. So they didn't want to get rid of this. So I find it just a little bit disconcerting to hear him say that, well, they could work at this and refine their art. So there were some dancers. Dancing is an art, and it's hard work.
Oh yeah.
But sometimes just the chorus line stuff is not so hard. Also, some of the things they do are pretty amazing. And then at 35, they could leave it, marry, and settle down. I don't know how easy that is. Although women did it, a lot of people did it. They still were married to somebody later on in their life, maybe even during
sure.
that time. So that's people needed jobs, and that's one of the things that. Women have always been in demand for.
Yeah, that's
he was making
correct.
The best of a situation that he couldn't really just get rid of, you know.
Yeah, and you know, and that's an important point. It was a line of work for them, at least. You know, it was employment,
mm-hmm.
and you know that it was awfully bad times during the Weimar Republic with the depression and inflation and food supplies and things like this. And even in our little headline, it said encouragement of prostitution. And that sort of encouragement was done by keeping their pay so low that they had to go to the streets. You know, if they had anyone to support, an elderly parent or even children, they had no other choice. And so that's
yeah.
the positive turn I take on this.
Well,
you
should. You're right. And it's true also that young women love to go on the stage and want to do things like that. They want to,
sure.
You know. They like to show off their good looks and so on, and they like that kind of thing. So it's not just, they're not being forced into it.
That's right.
In going into the theater, you know, how many people would think they'd like to do that until they experience it, maybe. But I'll just say that he was certainly thinking about women's employment and helping. And thinking of women being employed, he wasn't saying that no women should go out to work. They should all just stay home. So he was looking after single working women,
sure.
If that was what they needed to do.
Well, and also, Carolyn, early on in this part, he says, of primary importance were the measures we took to ensure a living wage for working women, such as secretaries, shop girls,
yeah,
artists,
right,
and the like. So it included women generally.
That's right. And of course, he loved his secretaries. They all knew they needed women for secretaries. They liked the women. You know,
sure.
Then men could do something else. They didn't want women to just quit working altogether and have no, you know. They just thought they were best in certain things and to stay out of certain other areas. I go along with that pretty much. If the men in the society are doing the right thing, like I feel the National Socialists were, then I can go along with that with no problem at all.
Sure.
Well, okay, we're going to the 21st. The timeline tells us that the invasion of Malta was postponed indefinitely. On this date, in discussions with Winston Churchill and Anthony Eden Molotov, the Russian foreign minister continues, just like he was doing with Germany, he continues to press Soviet demands for territorial acquisitions made during the run-up to war, including the Baltic states, eastern Poland, and Bessarabia. Churchill cannot or will not agree to these demands, and so the talks become deadlocked. It says.
Okay. This section that we're fixing to start is lengthy, and so we may stop and comment. There's a couple of places that I had marked there. 21st of May, 1942, after dinner. The assumption of power, negotiations with Papen, intrigues of Schleicher, my demand for the chancellorship and new elections, refusal to assume office except by legal means, danger of military dictatorship and a military putsch. General Hammerstein tries intimidation. Political greed of the German Nationalist Party. Hindenburg sides with me. Lomberg neutralizes the Wehrmacht. Only two Nazis in the first cabinet. The tortuous role of Papen. Initial difficulties. My relations with Hindenburg become more close. Hindenburg rebuffs the King of Sweden. When I roundly refuse to consider any compromise and accept the vice chancellorship in a von Papen cabinet, and after the vain and treacherous attempts of General Schleicher, supported by Gregor Strasser, had failed to split the solid unity of the party, political tension reached its zenith. Not only did Schleicher fail to win over a log-rolling majority in the Reichstag, but as a result of his go-slow policy as regards national economy, the number of unemployed rose during the first 15 days of his regime by no less than 250,000. In January 1933, 1 month, that is, after his assumption of office, Schleicher saw no other alternative but to dissolve the Reichstag and form a military cabinet upheld solely by the support of the President of the Reich. But the idea of a military dictatorship, in spite of his great personal confidence in General Schleicher, filled old von Hindenburg with the liveliest apprehension. For in his heart of hearts, the old gentleman was opposed to soldiers meddling in politics. Besides that, he was not prepared to go further in the delegation of political plenipotentiary power that he felt himself able to do in accordance with his constitutional oath. Faced with this situation of extreme political tension, von Hindenburg, through the intermediary of von Papen, approached me and in the famous Cologne conversations explored the ground. For myself, I had the impression that all was going well for me. I made it quite clear, therefore, that I would not hear of any compromise, and threw myself, heart and soul, personally into the Lippe electoral campaign. After the electoral victory at Lippe, a success whose importance it is not possible to overestimate, the advisors of the old gentleman approached me once more. A meeting was arranged at Ribbentrop's house with Hindenburg's son and Herr von Papen. At this meeting, I gave an unequivocal description of my reading of the political situation and declared without mincing words that every week of hesitation was a week irretrievably wasted. The situation, I said, could be saved only by an amalgamation of all parties, omitting, of course, those fragmentary bourgeois parties which were of no importance and which in any case would not join us. Such an amalgamation, I added, could be successfully assured only with myself as Reich Chancellor. At this juncture, I deliberately neglected my work within the party in order to take part in these negotiations because I considered it of the highest importance that I should legitimately take over the chancellorship with the blessing of the old gentleman. For it was only as constitutionally elected chancellor, obviously, and before undertaking any measures of reconstruction, that I could overcome the opposition of all the other political parties and avoid finding myself in constant conflict with the Wehrmacht. My decision to attain power constitutionally was influenced primarily by my knowledge of the attitude of the Wehrmacht vis-à-vis the chancellorship. If I had seized power illegally, the Wehrmacht would have constituted a dangerous breeding place for a coup d'etat in the nature of the Rome Putsch. By acting constitutionally, on the other hand, I was in a position to restrict the activities of the Wehrmacht to its legal and strictly limited military function, at least until such a time as I was able to introduce conscription. Once that was accomplished, the influx into the Wehrmacht of the masses of the people, together with the spirit of National Socialism and with the ever-growing power of the National Socialist movement, would, I was sure, allow me to overcome all opposition among the armed forces, and in particular in the Corps of Officers. On the 24th of January, 1933, the day after the SA assault on the Karl Liebknecht House in Berlin had resulted in a tremendous loss of prestige for the Communist Party and caused great indignation in Berlin, I was again invited by von Papen to a conference. Von Papen told me once that Schleicher had formally asked the old gentleman for plenipotentiary powers to set up a military dictatorship, but that the latter had refused and had stated that he proposed inviting Adolf Hitler in the role of leader of a national front to accept the chancellorship and to form a government, with the proviso that von Papen should be nominated vice chancellor. I replied that I took cognizance of the offer and, without permitting any discussion of detail, stated the conditions under which I was prepared to accept. These were the immediate dissolution of the Reichstag and the organization of new elections. Under the pretext that I should be away from Berlin, I avoided a tentative suggestion that I should have a 10-minute talk with the old gentleman. Mindful of the experiences of the previous year, I was anxious to avoid giving rise to any undue optimism within the party, such as was invariably the case whenever I was received by the old gentleman.
Well, let's take a look at this.
Yeah, good. Okay.
What's happening here is that he's being offered something that might look pretty good, the vice chancellorship. How many people would say, well, I can take that and work my way up with it or something? But he saw it as a dead end, and it was not the way
right.
he pictured it. Plus, he knew he was on a roll. I mean, he seemed to he says here that he could tell things were going well for him. You know, it's like everything fell into place for him. Of course, he had done a lot of work on it. And the other thing to remember, I mean, a lot of preparation, in a sense, you know, just even mentally, you know, picturing what he wanted and so on. And then the other thing to remember is that he emphasizes here how he knew he had to do it constitutionally. And so he wanted the blessing of Hindenburg. And then he, in order to, as he points out here, very important, I think, so that the army, and particularly the officer corps, who were not friendly to him, you know, at all, really, generally,
right,
would not be able to somehow, you know, go against him and take him down or do something, because he had the approval of Hindenburg, and everything was done in an orderly fashion. So that he really worked that out carefully, and he was of course correct in it, and it all fell into place. So it's pretty interesting, and the fact that he's talking about all this now, I don't know what brought it on. There's nothing says, but they probably wanted to get some of this on record, and they say, why don't you talk about your taking of power and how that happened,
right,
and so on, or they ask him,
right,
a question about it. So he did, and so here we're getting what he has to say about it.
Right, and with that offering him the vice chancellorship, well, that's kind of like offering a guy the vice presidency. You know, I think that about anybody in the United States, when the party's nominating, they offer a guy the vice presidency, it's kind of like ho-hum, you know, it's a figurehead. And Hitler knew that this would be meaning that the failure, the clique of failure, would still be in control of everything, and he had to have control, and he stuck by his guns. And one thing here, where it says on the 24th of January 1933, the day after the SA assault on the Karl Liebknecht House in Berlin, resulted in tremendous loss of prestige for the Communist Party and caused great indignation in Berlin. Now, that was significant to me because Karl Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, they were communist Jews heading up what they call the Spartacist movement, trying to subvert all of Germany into communism. And the only force that would stand up to their intimidation and their street fighters and all were the National Socialists. And if it hadn't been for Hitler and his people, the communists probably would have triumphed. But the significant thing here, the SA assaulted the Karl Liebknecht House in Berlin, and it says, and it caused great indignation in Berlin. And to me, that means the powers that be in Berlin were ticked off at the National Socialists for going in and kicking some communist butt. And that's kind of the way I took it, and that shows that the people in power were not the kind at all that were going to do Germany any good.
Well, there you go. Right, and do you know why they did that? I didn't check the history of that, and I don't really know anything about it, what happened that the SA attacked the Karl Liebknecht house.
I can only speculate, Carolyn, but I think it had something to do with the elections and the communists trying to still use their intimidation, because they knew that there was such a groundswell now for votes for the National Socialist candidates. And they were intent on using their intimidation and physical attacks as they had done in the past. And the SA got together and said, "We're gonna go into the beehive itself and rattle a few cages." And
well, they must have done something to to give
the
SA a pretext for doing,
That's right.
For doing that, but I don't know what it was exactly.
Yeah.
I guess everybody listening to him knows, so
yeah,
we'll have to look that up after the fact here.
Okay.
I'll do that after the show tonight. Yeah, so going on.
Okay, good. Going on, I took the opportunity in this conversation with Herr von Papen of pressing home my advantage and carrying a step further the negotiations started by Göring for the tentative formation of a government. It was with the German nationalists that the negotiations proved most difficult, for Geheimrat Hugenberg displayed a greed for portfolios out of all proportion to the strength of his party, and because he feared that he would probably lose a great number of votes in any new elections, he would not hear of an early dissolution of the Reichstag. On January 27th, after a short absence from Berlin, I had a personal conference with Hugenberg, but we were unable to agree. The negotiations for the formation of a government were further complicated by General Schleicher and his clique, who did all in their power to wreck them. General von Hammerstein, Schleicher's most trusted colleague and commander-in-chief of the army, was even stupid enough to have the impertinence to ring me up and tell me that under no circumstances would the Wehrmacht sanction my acceptance of the chancellorship. If Herr Schleicher and his friends really imagined they could shake my determination with puerilities of this sort, they were grievously mistaken. My only reaction was to impress emphatically on Göring to accept as Minister of the Reichswehr only a general who enjoyed my confidence, such as General von Blomberg, who had been recommended to me by my friends in East Prussia. On the 28th of January, the Weimar Republic...
I was looking up Hammerstein and find out that he was always very much against Hitler, even more than Schleicher was. Both these guys were, but Hammerstein was even more so. And Hammerstein was his aide and colleague.
Commander-in-chief of the army, yeah.
Yeah, pretty high up stuff.
Opposition,
really?
That's right. So, on the 28th of January, the Weimar Republic...
I need to find out what that date is because I didn't have it. 28th. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry about
28th
that.
Of January, the Weimar Republic finally collapsed. Schleicher resigned, and von Papen was instructed to sound the various parties with a view to the formation of a new government. For my own part, I at once declared that any half measures were now unacceptable to me. The 29th, naturally, was buzzing with conferences, in the course of which I succeeded in obtaining Hugenberg's agreement to the dissolution of the Reichstag in return for the promise to give him the number of seats in the new government which he had originally demanded for his party, convincing him that with the Reichstag in its present form, it would be impossible to achieve anything. The next afternoon, Göring brought me the news that on the morrow, the old gentleman proposed officially to invite me to accept the chancellorship and the task of forming the government. Late in the afternoon, we were surprised by a completely insane action by Schleicher and his clique. According to information received from Lieutenant Colonel von Albensleben, General von Hammerstein had put the Potsdam garrison on an alarm footing. The old gentleman was to be bundled off to East Prussia to prevent his interference, and the Wehrmacht was to be mobilized to stop by force the assumption of power by the National Socialist, the NSDAP. My immediate counteraction to this planned putsch was to send for the commander of the Berlin SA, Graf Heldorf, and through him to alert the whole SA of Berlin. At the same time, I instructed Major Wecke of the police, whom I knew I could trust, to prepare for a sudden seizure of the Wilhelmstrasse by 6 police battalions. Through Herr von Papen, I informed the old gentleman of the Schleicher clique's intentions. Finally, I instructed General von Blomberg, who had been selected as Reichswehr Minister-elect, to proceed at once on arrival in Berlin at 8 a.m. on the 30th of January, direct to the old gentleman to be sworn in and thus to be in a position as Commander-in-Chief of the Reichswehr to suppress any possible attempts at a coup d'etat. By 11 o'clock on the morning of the 30th of January, I was able to inform the old gentleman that the new cabinet had been formed and that the majority in the Reichstag required by constitution to enable it to function had been acquired. Shortly afterwards, I received at the hands of the old gentleman my appointment as Chancellor of the German Reich. At the beginning, my task as the head of this cabinet was the reverse of simple. With the exception of Frick, I had initially not one single National Socialist member of the cabinet. It is true that some of the others, like Blomberg and Neurath, had promised me their support, but the remainder were quite determined to go their own way. Gerecki, the commissioner of labor, who a little later was arrested and found guilty of embezzlement, was from the beginning my most persistent opponent. I was therefore very pleased when the Celtic came and declared that the die was cast and that in future his party would do nothing that might hinder my efforts. Apart from the difficulties inherent in the formation of a government, I very quickly realized that the old gentleman had called upon me to accept the chancellorship only because he could see no other constitutional way out of the political impasse. This was obvious from the number of conditions he imposed. He informed me, for instance, that all questions connected with the Reichswehr, the Foreign Office, and overseas appointments remained in his hands. He further decided that von Papen must be present whenever he received me officially, and it was only after much hesitation and the intervention of Meissner that the old gentleman was pleased to sign the order for the dissolution of the Reichstag, which I had managed to rattle through during the session of the 31st of January. Within a week or so, however, my relations with Hindenburg began to improve. One day, when he wanted to see me about something or other, I invited his attention to the custom he himself had established, namely, that I could not visit him except in the company of von Papen, and pointed out that the latter was at the moment away from Berlin. The old gentleman replied that he wished to see me alone, and that in future the presence of von Papen could be regarded as unnecessary. Within 3 weeks, we had progressed so far that his attitude towards me became affectionate and paternal. Talking of the elections fixed for the 3rd of March, he said, "What are we going to do if you fail to get a majority? We shall have the same difficulties all over again." When later the first results of the elections began to come in, our relations had attained such a degree of frank cordiality that the old gentleman exclaimed in a voice charged with real satisfaction, "Hitler wins!" And when the overwhelming victory of the National Socialists was confirmed, he told me straight out that he had always been averse to the parliamentary game and was delighted that the comedy of elections was now done with, once and for all. That the old gentleman, in spite of his advanced age, still remained a great man was well demonstrated by the way he handled a situation arising out of a report on the disarmaments negotiations from Ambassador Nadolny. Nadolny proposed to acquiesce in a proposal that Germany should at once proceed with her disarmament, and that of the remaining powers should follow in a few years' time. After I had rejected this proposal out of hand and had informed the old gentleman of my action, Nadolny, without consulting me, begged audience of Hindenburg. The old gentleman flung him out and told me afterwards that he had not been in the least taken in by Nadolny's arguments, but had indeed dismissed him with a brusque, "You're pro-Moscow. Very well, you'd better push off there." This incident is a typical example of the way in which the old gentleman reduced every problem to its simplest denominator. He had completely succeeded in unraveling the tangled intrigues woven against us at Geneva, which were tantamount simply to our binding ourselves to obligations which the others had not the slightest intention of honoring. In the same direct manner, within a few minutes of MacDonald's handing to Germany the demands made of her in the League of Nations, he sanctioned the release to the world's press by Funk, the Reich press chief, of the news that Germany was withdrawing from the League. When the German people, with a huge 95% majority, expressed approval of the decision, and incidentally of my policy, the old gentleman was delighted. I'm going to stop here a second. At this time, the reparations and demands made on Germany by the League and all this, telling them to disarm, and that the original proposal by Wilson was that everybody disarm. You know, throw all your armaments in a pile and burn them and whatever, and we'll have peace. And only Germany followed the original dictates and gave up many, many arms and weapons, things like that. and only Germany followed it. And the French took advantage of a disarmed Germany, of course, marched into the Ruhr, seized the coal mines,
That was one of the rottenest things. That's one of the things they cover up in history.
That's Germany,
believing they were dealing with honorable people or felt they had to be honorable, when they insisted, well, Germany, you put yours down first and then we'll follow. And so Germany thought, well, okay, I'll have to do that. So they did it. And these dishonorable, I can't say the word I'd like to use for these men in these countries, didn't do it. And yet they act like Germany's at fault and Germany deserved all this. You know, they're playing the same game in both world wars. So it's incredible. It's just incredible what they did and what rotten liars they are. And then they say, as you were probably going to say, they said, well, the remaining powers will follow. And then with the after a slash line, in a few years' time.
in a few years' time.
Exactly right. They didn't say that in the beginning.
That's right. And you know, initially after the war, when Germany had surrendered and all this, the Versailles Conference had taken place, and everybody jumped in to demand the reparations, and the French especially, they pulled that stunt of marching into the Ruhr Valley and seizing the coal mines. It was one of the coldest winters on record, and the French took control of the German coal mines and were shipping the coal back to France. And many, many Germans were trying to get coal to stay warm, to stay alive in the winter, and they froze to death because the damn French did that to them. And not only that, but the French occupied Germany with colonial troops, meaning Africans and from any other French colony, and they victimized many, many German civilians with rape.
But you know that coal thing, they ought to be, they should have been brought up on war crimes charges or something.
That's right.
You know,
that's
for
exactly
doing
right.
that. They had absolutely, it's absolutely no international, nothing was established to allow them to do that. But of course, if nobody complains and they're in control and they're in the majority, like they were in the League of Nations and so on, then there's really nothing you can do about it. So international law is a big joke, and mainly it's something invented by Jews. Jews are the ones who came up with international law. You can't really have international law because, you know, you sign these agreements, but they don't really mean anything. So it's a big fake, and yet Jews came up with it and are still there. Just about every international lawyer and law department and so on there exists. It's all made up of Jews.
Well, your point a minute ago, Carolyn, about this is history not taught. You know, where is this recorded down, what they did to Germany after the war? And even more heinous crime to me was the British maintaining that naval blockade, and people in Germany were starving, and America got word of a lot of that stuff, and it was Herbert Hoover who headed up a relief effort with tons of medicine and food that was shipped over there, and the damn British Navy cut it off and wouldn't let the Germans have it, and 800,000 German children died as a result of that naval blockade by England 2 years after the war was over. And yet, all these ignorant people, when history is read, none of that's mentioned, and they've got sympathy for France, and they've got sympathy for England, and they're saying, those damn mean Germans, how could they strike out like that?
The Belgians!
Know?
The poor Belgians!
Poor Belgian. And
that's all you hear
all
about.
All of these seeds of hatred were being sowed in Germany, and rightful indignation,
angrier. But you know, Ray, it's mentioned, but they just gloss over it. It isn't mentioned if it doesn't have to be, but if it's in enough of a real history lesson, well, you know, it'll kind of be mentioned. But they don't continue with it. They don't carry on what they should say about it, and they go right back to what's wrong with Germany. And make things up. So, it's criminal, if you ask me. Criminal history. It's a crime.
Absolutely is.
Historians shouldn't allow it, and these historians that allow it are are scum, you know, they're not real historians.
True. And one personal satisfaction I had out of that, Carolyn, I'd like to mention, I was teaching at the college, and of course, as a subscriber to the Barnes Review, there were many, many excellent articles in there about that very thing, and I contacted Barnes Review and asked if I could use a couple of articles, and they sent back and said, sure. I told them I wanted to reprint them and assign them to my class for reading and to write response papers on. And the Barnes Review said, certainly, just give us the credit for the review and an address or whatever in case anybody wants to subscribe. So I had my students read the article, excellent article, about the British blockade and about the 800,000 German children dying, starving to death, and about the French seizing the coal mines. And the response papers I got from my students were absolutely wonderful. Many of them said, you know, I never knew that Germany was done that way. And it also mentioned in the articles that in most cases, Jews were responsible for that very thing. And those students says, I can't blame the Germans for hating the Jews for what they did to them, particularly after World War One. So a little light came on among some of these students, and it was so good to read that. You know, you just present them with this honest history and a reality, mm-hmm. and because their minds are still available, you know, have the ability to think a little bit for themselves, they took to it and they
accepted
it.
Sure, they would, you know. That's why they control the history in this education so much, because if young people got any of this, they respond to it right away the way it should be responded to.
And that's why they want to nip it in the bud and make sure that teachers like me do not occupy the classroom.
That's right.
They don't care how
stupid these teachers are. I'm not talking about so much the college level, but in high school and on down, the teachers are such a low level of understanding themselves, and they just follow their lesson plans. They don't question anything.
Yeah, well, it's the same in college when it comes to history and government and politics. So.
Yeah, it really is. It's not so highfalutin, you know. College and even university today is not even hardly difficult. So they just put pass people through like they started doing in for high school, and you might as well. You don't hardly know anything when you graduate from the university.
That's right.
Gosh, not like it was.
No, that's true.
Okay.
Anyway, we'll move on here. The old gentleman was wonderful, too, in his appreciation of the situation as regards the reoccupation of the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland, and carried his point by sheer forceful personality. The various ministers, on the contrary, had to be won over, one by one, to the idea of the entry of the Wehrmacht into this zone. Von Papen was even filled with anxiety lest the French should take a retaliatory measure to take retaliatory measures of occupation. I myself, however, stuck to my opinion that the French could be allowed to occupy Mainz, provided that we recaptured our liberty of action and were in a position to do what we liked in the rest of the Reich, and were first and foremost in a position to rearm. Subsequent events proved that I was right. It is true that in order to set the minds of the people at rest, I went personally to the Rhineland. But the German people, by giving me a 99% majority in the elections to the Reichstag on the 29th of March 1936, proved conclusively that they both understood and approved my policy. It was by no means easy to convince the old gentleman, but once one had done so, he always gave his fullest support to whatever it might be. For instance, at first he would not hear of any anti-Semitic measures, but when at a dinner at the Swedish legation, at which both were present, the King of Sweden expressed certain criticisms of the German policy towards the Jews, the old gentleman refuted them, saying in his deep, sonorous bass voice that this was purely domestic German affair, with which the German Chancellor alone was competent to deal.
Let me just mention here, Ray, that this brought to mind to me that, once again, that it's only the Germans who seem to have what it takes to deal with standing up to the Jews. Now, of course, most of the Germans weren't willing to do it at that time either.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I shouldn't even say it's the Germans. It's really just the National Socialist Germans. I don't know.
That's
it's
true.
A certain kind of Germans that do. But look at this. King of Sweden, he didn't like the German policy toward the Jews. And that was even just the general policy.
Sure.
At that time. And, so, you know, everybody else wants to bow down and cater to the Jews. Back they like their Jews. They're friends with them, I think, and they like them, and they don't want anything to happen to them.
So. The King of Sweden, you know, he assumed to chastise the Germans for their German policy toward the Jews. But, boy, I'll tell you, I was really proud of Hindenburg when he said, hey, this is a German affair, and only our German chancellor is competent to deal with it. And nipped it in the bud. Right there, that's courage. And Hindenburg had reversed his own position because it said originally he would not hear of any anti-Semitic measures. But he grew in time to understand.
Well, he appreciated, he obviously saw the intelligence and the qualities in Hitler, that he was getting things done and he was looking out in the interests of Germany. And Hindenburg was certainly enough of a patriot, and you can't doubt that. To appreciate that, and he learned to really appreciate Hitler and working with him and knowing him. So it was only the people who really didn't have, who really weren't true patriots, who would have been truthfully against Hitler. And a lot of those people were communists or communist sympathizers, or very much leftists.
That's right. That's true. Anyway, moving on. I had some difficulty also in persuading the old gentleman of the necessity of curtailing the liberty of the press. On this occasion, I played a little trick on him and addressed him not as a civilian with Mr. President, but as a soldier with Field Marshal, and developed the argument that in the Army, criticism from below was never permitted. Only the reverse, for what would happen if the NCO passed judgment on the orders of the captain? The captain on those of the general, and so on. This the old gentleman admitted, and without further ado approved of my policy, saying, you are quite right, only superiors have the right to criticize. And with these words, the freedom of the press was doomed. For the fact that the old gentleman so faithfully followed my lead and always did his utmost to understand my intentions, I am deeply grateful. To what extent he had to free himself from old ideas in the process is shown by his remarks on the appointment of Gauleiter Hildebrandt to the post of Reichsstatthalter. The old gentleman signed the appointment, growling as he did so. The fellow was only a farm laborer. Isn't he content with having been made a member of the Reichstag and being given the opportunity of spending the rest of his life in peace and quiet there? Once I had won him over to my side, the old gentleman's solicitude toward me was truly touching. Again and again, he said that he had a chancellor who was sacrificing himself for his country, and that often he could not sleep at night for thinking of his chancellor flying from one part of the Reich to another in the service of the people. What an eternal shame it was, he added, that such a man must belong to one party.
Yeah, so he meant that he couldn't just be a man of the people, but had to be one party in the midst of other parties.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Which is what Hitler finally did. He finally abolished the parties.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have all that fighting going on.
So.
Okay, well, I think that's very good, and I had some little thought there.
Okay.
But I can't think of it, and I forgot it.
This sentence kind of jumped at me as something the opposition would hammer on and jump on right quick, and it was where Hitler says, I had some difficulty also in persuading the old gentleman of the necessity of curtailing the liberty of the press.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then your liberals jump all over that, and your teachers of false history and things like that. Say, well, look at there. He clamped down on the press, did not allow them to print and whatever. But, you know, in that phrase, the curtailing of the liberty of the press, that in a more general sense meant the press issuing damaging stories and criticisms and what have you that were hurting the German state and undermining what the National Socialist Party, who was in power by vote, from doing, trying to curtail, you know, anything successes they might have. And so if the press was going to be allowed to continue, they had to do so in a responsible manner and in essence, take the Jews out of the ability to control the press.
Well, yeah, and, you know, he even says here the freedom of the press was doomed. Well, you know, the freedom of the press is overrated because the press
That's
is
right.
all bought off working for, you know, and particularly now more and more, you know. I mean, the press, for the most part, is in the hands of the government. Well, that's what Hitler did. He put the press in the hands of his government. So he didn't do anything different than what they're doing, although they try to pretend like it's not, like they're not doing it, whereas he was more honest about things. So the timeline for the 22nd is only one little thing, that Mexico declares war on the act. Not that that made a big difference, but they were symbolically.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, more than as seen just by looking at that headline, Mexico declares war on the Axis. Behind that headline is the fact that then the United States could claim to rush into Mexico with troops and arms or whatever under pretense that it was going to be attacked by Germany, or that there could be a threat of the Germans coming up through Mexico to attack the United States. So that's, once again, the pretense shown to allow the country to violate the sovereignty of another one.
Well, so, right, and, you know, it's just... But, you know, I really like this next section, Ray.
Oh,
that's
I do, too. I'm glad
favorite.
You said that, because I was going to say it before I started it. The man, he's really after my heart here with some of the things he says regarding crime and punishment. 22nd May 1942, midday. Recruiting spies, the need for barbarous methods, weaknesses of the judges, habit encourages crime. Spies nowadays are recruited from two classes of society, the so-called upper classes and the proletariat. The middle classes are too serious-minded to indulge in such activity. The most efficient way of combating espionage is to convince those who are tempted to dabble in it that if they're caught, they will most certainly lose their lives. In the same way, I'm of the opinion that one should proceed with the utmost severity against other contemptible forms of crime which have sprung up under war conditions. For instance, theft under the cover of the blackout. For, except by truly barbaric methods, how can one suppress such crimes under cover of the blackout as bag snatching, assaults on women, housebreaking when the cellar door is left open, and so on? For all such crimes, there must be one penalty alone, the death penalty, whether the evildoer is 70 or 17 years of age. Bingo, my friend.
Yeah, well, you know, now, that hits me as pretty severe, you know. When I read that, I'm thinking, gosh, the death penalty for stealing somebody's handbag? But, you know, see, that's the conditioning that that I have, that we have, that the crime has to be, it depends on how bad the crime is, and if it isn't so bad, well, then you make excuses for the criminal because he's out of money or he's this or he's something or other. But, what you know, we talked about this before, about the people who have to have put up with stuff like this. It shouldn't
sure.
be. And, of course, he's using the war conditions. He wouldn't do this under non-war conditions, but he's using war conditions to be exceptionally serious about it. And then he explains it more, which makes some sense. It might not convince everybody, but...
Well,
he does.
And you got to keep in mind, Carolyn, what he just said, under cover of the blackout. Now, why is
right.
the blackout demanded? Because the cities are in danger of being bombed or attacked or whatever. So they institute a blackout. And that's mm-hmm. to try to take care of the people. And then you have an element in society that, oh boy, here's our license to steal, to rob,
right.
do whatever we can. Well, certainly, I can readily see why he would say death penalty, death penalty. I don't care if you're 17 or 17
years old. We should have the death penalty for those rioters who, because something happens between one of their people and law enforcement, they think it gives them the right to destroy property
yep.
and tear things up. No, they should have a very, very severe, maybe not the death penalty, people would go crazy, but, you know, like a 10-year prison sentence or something. Well, you'd have all these people in prison, and you don't really want all these people in prison.
No,
one
shoot
reason
them down.
For the death penalty is to, is not to give a society even more problems, because they just get together in prison and continue
right.
their criminal activities.
You don't arrest people like that, put handcuffs on them, take them to jail and charge them and then put them on trial. You shoot them down. When they're breaking property and stealing and everything, you just shoot them down and leave them laying. And
it'll stop real quick, too.
It would stop very quickly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. A sane society would do that. Anyway, Hitler goes on, unless in wartime one punishes crime in the homeland with the utmost severity, two dangers will arise. A, the numbers of the criminal classes will increase and become uncontrollable. B, one will have the anachronism of the decent man losing his life at the front while the criminal at home gets away with it, because he knows full well that for such and such a crime he can, under paragraph so-and-so, only be imprisoned for a specified period. One must clearly understand that in wartime, the population divides itself into three categories, the out-and-out idealist, the out-and-out egotist, and the betwixt and betweens. If we permit the blackguard to be treated with mercy at home while the idealists are dying in large numbers on the field, then we're paving the way for a reverse process of selectivity and showing that we have forgotten the lessons of the World War in 1917-18. I maintain, therefore, that there is no alternative. The man at the front may die. The blackguard at home must die. Any state which is not prepared to accept this principle has not the right to expose its idealists to death in the field. The judges of today have no clear notion of their duties. For the most part, they were appointed before we took power, and like the priesthood, have succeeded in maintaining their corporate entity in spite of changes of regime, and have therefore conserved all their liberal tendencies. I feel myself constrained in the circumstances to intervene, and I shall not hesitate to dismiss ruthlessly any judge who consistently gives judgment harmful to the good of the people and contrary to the national outlook, for I feel that it is my personal responsibility to see that there does not spring up a race of rascals on the home front, such as we had in 1918, while our men die heroically on the battlefield. Discipline at the front demands rules of iron, and it would be an injustice to the front line to allow mercy to hold sway at home. Also, as regards young persons, the methods employed in wartime must be different from those applied in times of peace, and among them, leniency finds no place. In peacetime, of course, with a young 15 or 17-year-old delinquent, one can substitute a damn good hiding for a period of imprisonment, because if he has an ounce of decency in him, he will feel that prison has sullied his whole life, and apart from that, he may well pick up all sorts of criminal tricks from the old lags. One of the young Seafells, for example, was once condemned for offenses against public decency, and while in prison, learnt from other criminals how to distill a poison which left no trace whatever 20 minutes after use. As I believed that this young criminal had committed many more crimes than those to which he confessed in court, I caused him to be handed over to the Gestapo. After 12 hours in a superheated cell without water, he not only confessed to 107 more murders, but also showed the officials the places where all the bodies were buried. Experience shows that unnatural offenders generally turn into homicidal maniacs. They must be rendered harmless, however young they may be. I have therefore always been in favor of the strongest possible punishment of these antisocial elements. Law and order.
Yeah. Well, we seem to have lost our sense for that. You know, we don't want to punish anybody for anything. We want to punish the harmless people, the good people, for wanting to bring about law and order and
truth.
Well,
and that's
what we're doing.
You're right. You're right. And that's Jewish influence
that has led to that. Right.
It hasn't
just happened. It has to be a plan. You know, you can't do anything as stupid as we're doing in our world today without it being a plan to destroy everything that is good.
What the Jews have done with their infestation of the legal system, the courts and all, purposely have changed all of our black and white understanding to gray mm-hmm. areas. You know, well, you know, you got to consider that this, he had a bad childhood, or you know, mm-hmm. instead of just, hey, it's down in black and white. He committed the crime. He's got to pay for it. And if it's with the ultimate penalty, that's the way it's going to be. And as I say, turning it to the gray area, well, let's measure all these circumstances that might have caused this. And that's a Jewish conception designed for us, not for them. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a whole other book.
Well, that's right. This might come up again. Well, I've got some timeline here for the.
Okay.
Some of it's important. I'm going to skip some of it, the extra details. But 23rd, Kleist, General Kleist and General Paulus's tanks meet up at Balaklia, southeast of Kharkov. They're doing well. They encircled most of the Soviet 6th and 9th armies. And then in the United Kingdom, the high-level talks with the Soviet Union, with Molotov, Anthony Eden suggests abandoning attempts to reach any territorial understanding and just conclude a 20-year alliance between the two nations. And Molotov is his position is weakening because of these battles that I just mentioned, and that the military situation at Kerch and Kharkov has deteriorated for the Soviets. So that has weakened his position. See, the Anglo-Soviet treaty, their foreign secretaries agree that no peace will be signed by one without the approval of the other. And this is an important treaty since Himmler and others will attempt to separate the two nations at the end of the war. Well, that's what the Wikipedia is saying. Rommel begins a spring offensive, you know, and so on. And this is on the 25th. And on the 26th of May, Rommel disperses the 3rd Indian Motorized Brigade. Some 600 are taken prisoner and released in the desert, and he will make their way to Bir Hakeim. Well, this offensive lasts well into June with a total victory for Rommel. This is the 26th of 1942, May. Okay.
Right.
Now, we have what day next?
29th of May, 1942, midday. Lola Montez, and that's Montez, and Ludwig I of Bavaria. Hostility of the church. Personality of Ludwig I. Respect for racial characteristics.
Ray, maybe I should just say that I don't have all my timeline. You know, it was on the 27th of May that Heydrich was shot and that bomb was thrown at his car. And he's hurt and in the hospital. And it was called Operation Anthropoid by the Czechoslovak soldiers at the direction of the English. Anyway, that was the 27th, but it's not it's not mentioned, and Hitler doesn't say anything about it.
Yeah,
so we're now
June the 4th.
So now we're at May 29th.
Yes. On a proposal by Dr. Goebbels to produce a film of Lola Montez, Hitler says, "I welcome the idea, but you must take care that neither the fate of this woman nor the personality of King Ludwig I of Bavaria is in any way distorted. Lola Montez had nothing in common with the dancers of our times, striptease artists, but was a woman of exceptional intelligence with wide experience of the world. She was, too, a woman of character, as is shown by the way she resisted the Catholic Church and, in spite of enormous pressure, refused to kowtow to it. As regards the personality of Ludwig I, you must be careful, too, not to portray him as first and foremost a skirt chaser, Scherzenjäger. He was, in every sense, a great man and was the finest architect of his time in Europe. The idea and execution of the Valhalla building alone show him to have been a monarch whose vision stretched far beyond the confines of his own petty state and embraced the whole pan-German panorama. Apart from that, we have to thank him for having given in the city of Munich a magnificent art center to the German nation. That he is nevertheless one of the most controversial figures among the kings of Bavaria is attributable to the fact that the church never ceased to harry him. The attacks of the latter on Lola Montez were only a pretext, and it was in reality the strong liberal tendencies of the king at which the attacks were aimed. You must not, therefore, represent Ludwig I as a king of the Viennese charm school, something after the style of Paul Horsbiger, but rather as a worthy monarch. But rather as a worthy monarch, and I think Kessler is the best man for the role. While respecting their racial characteristics, I have, in the interest of the Reich, divided my Austrian homeland into a series of Alpine and Danubian provinces. I have decided to act the same way as regards other portions of the Reich. I shall not, for example, permit that West Friesland continue to form part of Holland, for these West Frieslanders are of exactly the same race as the people of East Friesland and must therefore be united with them within a single province.
Well, that's interesting in that, you know, he thinks if the people of the same race should be in the same country and shouldn't be cut off from one another. That's what he's saying there, and he respects racial characteristics.
That's right, for harmony.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Well, this next one is pretty long, too.
Yeah, sort of. The 30th of May, 1942, midday. Painters and sculptors. Influence of the epoch on painters. The role of Vienna. The death of Mozart. Artists should be supported before they die. I consider Brookman's art review to be inferior to those published by Professor Hoffman and the Minister of Propaganda. As regards the sculptors Kolbe and Klimt, I think the work of the former, an admitted master, tends to deteriorate as he grows older, while that of Klimt, on the other hand, seems with the years to become more and more finished and significant. But it is obviously unfair to reproach an artist because the work of his old age does not show the perfection of his earlier and greatest creations. With age, eyes grow feeble, and the sculptor in particular is dependent on his sight. When, as sometimes happens, sculptors surpass themselves in their old age, it is probably because they were previously short-sighted and, with the lengthening of sight that accompanies advancing age, had then become normal. Speaking generally, it would be unjust to reproach an artist, be he sculptor or singer, because his talents fade with age. Rather than emphasize the many faults that are to be found in the later works of Lovis Corinth, we should remember with delight the truly magnificent youth pictures of his earlier days. It should be the task of any reasonable culture policy to discover talent early, to encourage and foster it, and so give it the opportunity of reaching its highest fruition for the benefit of both the present and posterity. During the last few centuries, the Viennese, who always used to set such store by the cultural standards of their city, have neglected this most important principle of cultural policy in an almost insanely irresponsible fashion. For example, they actually allowed a genius like Mozart to starve. He was even buried in a pauper's grave, they say, and now no one knows where he lies. Like him, too, Bruckner and Haydn would have been allowed to die of hunger if they had not found patrons in the Bishop of Linz and the Prince von Esterhazy, respectively. These examples show that the Viennese, like the people of Munich, owe their accumulation of artistic wealth solely to their rulers. Between the Viennese and the people of Munich, however, there is this vital difference, that the latter do show a measure of appreciation to their living artists, while the former wait until an artist has been dead for perhaps centuries and has acquired an international reputation before giving their approval. Our own cultural policy can learn a lesson from this. It is that artists who do good work must be assured of recognition in good time. It is for this reason that I have caused to be organized the arts exhibition in the House of German Art in Munich, and not merely because I wish to give the already famous a chance to exhibit where their works will be seen by the whole world. By far the most important object of this exhibition is to seek out the best of German creative art and to put on exhibition and so before potential purchasers works honestly recognized by experts as meritorious, even when the artist is still unknown outside a narrow circle. At the same time, it will afford to purchasers a guarantee that anything they bought at this exhibition is worth having. Professor Hoffman's proposal that competition between artists should be stimulated by the award of gold and silver medals bearing a picture of the House of German Art is in complete accord with this object and should be adopted. One thing I want to say there, that's the end of that little section. Hitler's work is presented. I have a book called Hitler, the Unknown Artist by Billy, can't remember his last name, but has all kinds of watercolor drawings and paintings and things like this. And the title is Hitler, the Unknown Artist. And it's exactly like he says here. He wants their work, these German creators and artistic people, their works honestly recognized as meritorious, even when the artist is still unknown outside a narrow circle, and having been ignored and put down for his own talents, I know that that had a special place in his heart.
Well, maybe so. I don't think he made a whole lot out of not becoming a well-known artist or anything, because he realized that
True.
He would not
True.
Have become pure of Germany if he had, and that he had the opportunity.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was still thinking that he was going to do all this building, and he had already done some, and do all this building in Germany, architectural creations, which he was working on with with different architects. And this was his greatest happiness. He realized he had a great opportunity here. So, but I think that I know that, as we know, he's so familiar with the arts, and he meant the artists that he mentions are really artists of note and of a high quality, high level. And he knows the difference, you know, between them all. And he wanted to encourage artists and encourage art in Germany, in Third Reich Germany, you know, in his National Socialist Germany, that he was a little disappointed in the results of these shows, these annual shows at the Munich Art Museum, that the level was not as high as what he hoped for. But some of it was, you know, but a lot of it just wasn't. It was kind of mundane. But it was, the idea was there, you know, he wanted to encourage art, and you could buy the paintings there. It was an exhibition where you could also buy, everything had a price on it, so in order to help the artists too, you know, to encourage people to buy their art. And he bought a bunch of it. He went in there himself and bought a bunch of it. And he was always buying art. And with his own money that he got, like from his sale of his book and so on. So, he was just great in all of this, and he certainly always knew what he was talking about. But the Third Reich didn't really have time to inspire any really great art. There was some, well, there was a lot of really nice art. There was very good, but as far as world great art, of course, the world art is so under the influence of Jewish art and abstraction and so on. But there were some wonderful German artists there, and these two sculptors you mentioned, especially Kolbe, his stuff was very, very good. Some of it looks like what's at the Olympic Stadium, but I'm not sure. Maybe just something that looks like that. But, you know, really some distinctive Third Reich-looking art sculptures.
Oh, yeah. Right, and so, of course, the war put a cramp in a whole lot
sure,
of that.
Well, sure. There was very little time, you know. As it said, there's only, what, a few years, five or six years of peacetime or, you know, for the Third Reich. That's all they had. And they accomplished so much in that time.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is again, you know, showing his interest in all aspects of society, in everything that, every kind of activity that Germans do, he's behind it and he's supporting it.
Right.
Well, now we have the...
Man of the people, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, I got some more timelines now. Yeah, I mentioned the 29th, the Japanese forces are having large successes south of Shanghai. And there's something here about the USS Yorktown damaged at the Coral Sea, limps into Pearl Harbor. Oh, well. And Rommel turns his troops to Bir Hakeim on the south edge of the Gazala Line. Once it is taken, he can move north and destroy the Allied emplacements in the line. So things are looking good at this point at the end of May. But there's also, on the 30th of May, the 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne, revealing new area bombing techniques. That's what they say in Wikipedia about this. It reveals new area bombing techniques, not all the damage and the criminality of this raid.
That's right.
Yeah. And another item for the 30th is the USS Yorktown leaves Pearl after hasty repairs and moves to join the USS Enterprise for the next expected battle. You know, that's all they care. All they care about is what's happening with the English and the Americans. I've said that before, but and some with the Japanese.
Okay, the 31st of May, 1942, at dinner. Kaiser Wilhelm II, an ignoble monarch. The behavior of Wilhelm II in society was unworthy of a monarch. Not only did he consistently ridicule the members of his immediate entourage, but also fired a constant stream of ironic remarks at his guests for the amusement of the remainder. His bad taste and familiarity with other monarchs, backslapping and the like, robbed Germany of much sympathy. A monarch must learn that self-restraint and dignity must be observed in everyday life. The example of Wilhelm II shows how one bad monarch can destroy a dynasty. In the same way, those who wish to play their parts in history must understand that one single bad generation can cause the ruin of a whole people. That's a lot said right there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at how much more we have to go to get to the 4th, and it's quite a bit, so I don't know.
We'll cover
either
what we can.
Okay.
We've
talked about it. Maybe we'll have to hold that one off until next time.
We'll
see.
Okay.
So that was all about Kaiser Wilhelm. Well, I've heard all that before about Kaiser Wilhelm.
Right.
And all these darn timelines, there's a huge German success around Kharkov on the 31st with the envelopment of several Red Army armies. The British are having a lot of success with their Spitfires in Malta, and Rommel's offensive has stalled, but further heavy bombing of industrial sites in Germany centered mainly on Essen. Well, the Essen bombing was really, really bad, but they don't want to talk about it.
Right. So, 2nd June 1942 at dinner. Application of the laws of nature to aircraft and naval construction. Fish, birds, and the design of aircraft and ships, new fields of research, tradition, the enemy of invention. An animated conversation with Admiral Cranky on the principles governing the construction of means of transport, the Fuhrer speaks. One must start by accepting the principle that nature herself gives all the necessary indications, and that therefore one must follow the rules that she has laid down. Take the example of the bicycle. It suffices for me to remove in imagination the rims and the tires from the wheels to see that the movements of the spokes are exactly those of a man walking. In aviation, too, we see that the natural laws retain all their original value. The Zeppelin was, on this account, a completely artificial construction. Nature, obviously, has rejected the lighter-than-air principle. She has provided no bird with any sort of balloon, as she has done in the case of the fish. As far as I myself am concerned, I shall never consent to go up in a dirigible, but I have no shadow of anxiety in an airplane, even when flying through the worst storms. The current design of ships certainly does not conform to the laws of nature. If it did, then we should find fish furnished with some sort of propulsive element at the rear instead of the lateral fins with which they are endowed. Nature would also have given the fish a streamlined head instead of that shape which corresponds more or less exactly to a globule of water. One of the most doubtful blessings bestowed upon us by early Christian seafarers is the abandoning of the fish shape and the adoption in theory and practice of the principle which still governs the construction of even our latest vessels of the Nelson class, of pointed forward and blunt aft. In ship design, surely it is most necessary to imitate the ideas of nature and to adopt the design of a falling drop of water. For by thickening the prow, you reduce by so much, sans soviel, the pressure produced from in front on a pointed bow. It is only quite recently, too, that it has been realized that a pointed spade is not the best spade. Seeing that we have departed from the natural in the shape of our ships, it is not to be wondered at that we have found also a form of propulsion which is contrary to the example given us in nature by the fish. The screw fixed in the rear acts by suction, and the resultant vacuum acts as a brake on the ship's progress, while this brake effect is augmented by the resistance offered by the mass of water piling up at the bows. In nature, exactly the reverse happens. In front, suction by a vacuum, at the back, an inert mass of water tending to further the forward thrust. The fish moves forward by the action of its fins and by the propulsion of water through its gills. Happily, these principles have been remembered in the construction of airplanes, and the screws have been placed in front, whereby producing suction, they pull the plane forward. You cannot deny that the design and method of propulsion of the present-day ship are out of date. With warships, we have already come to the point where an addition of driving power does not lead to a corresponding increase of efficiency. You find that a battleship of over 45,000 tons with 136,000 horsepower engines steams at 30 knots, while an aircraft carrier of half the size with 200,000 horsepower engines raises only 35 knots. Something obviously is wrong with the mathematics of it. It is quite absurd that the addition of 75,000 horsepower to a ship of half the tonnage should give a speed increase of only 5 knots. And I can only hope that our naval experts will at last allow themselves to be persuaded that their current methods of ship design and construction are out of date. That we have made appreciably greater progress in the field of aviation and have attained an enormous increase in speed simply by modifying the shape of the fuselage is due principally to the work of Professor Junker, who has made a profound study of the laws of aerodynamics. In other words, of the laws of nature. It is therefore incomprehensible that the Navy should condemn as idiots such inventors as Fulton and Russell, who broke new ground simply because these new methods might have entailed a revolution in the art of seafaring. I have therefore ordered that the Soxton ship, with its motive power in front, should forthwith be built and given practical tests. I have further directed that tests be made of the practicability of propelling a ship by means of lateral screws, after the manner of fish fins, a system which may well give a ship greater powers of maneuver and enable it to put about on a pivot. These ideas of mine have been inspired by the thought that whenever man is brought to a standstill in any technical field, then a free hand should be given to new inventors in their search for the way ahead. In the case of the microscope, for example, the time is approaching when it will not be possible further to increase the number of lenses integrated, for each additional lens absorbs a little more light. Progress in this field, therefore, will be attained only by means of some revolutionary invention. Unfortunately, it is difficult in the extreme to secure acceptance for new inventions, for rare indeed are the men with minds sufficiently open and possessed of the strength of character to discard the work of a lifetime in favor of some new idea, especially when the latter may well emanate from some outsider. We all know with what immense difficulty the theory of Copernicus triumphed over that of Ptolemy, and what great effects it had on the life of the world. For with the Ptolemaic theory collapsed a world upon which the whole philosophy of the church was founded. At the time, it required great courage to declare oneself in favor of the Copernican theory and to take the consequences, for the church defended itself without mercy. Which is understandable, of course, for the more bigoted a man or an organization is, the more shattering becomes the impact of the revelation of their errors, and with it, the destruction of the whole basis of their thought. History shows that inventors have met much the same fate. The postmaster, who made the epoch-making discovery that it was possible to place a vehicle on rails and propel it by steam, was at the time uproariously ridiculed by the postal directors, that is, by the experts. The tragedy is that it is always an inventor's fate to attack something which is already established and which has therefore come to be regarded by the people as immutable. In addition, the initial effect of a new invention is invariably to create disorder. War, which gives added impetus to every form of activity, is therefore undoubtedly the most favorable atmosphere for invention. Aviation, for instance, made more progress in 3.5 years of war than in 30 years of peace. One has only to recollect that in 1906, it was taken as axiomatic that the airplane was valueless unless it could attain a speed of 25 miles an hour.
Sure, that sounds funny, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I like when he went into Copernicus, mm-hmm. triumph over that of Ptolemy, you know, with Copernicus telling everybody that the Earth revolved around the sun rather than the other way around. And of course, even Galileo came up with the idea that the Earth was not the center of the universe, the sun was. And those guys lost their jobs, were punished to the extreme, and he said what Copernicus came up with and the truth shocked the whole world. I mean, it had his theory really changed things. And
right.
He said, like he said, it required great courage to declare oneself in favor of Copernican theory.
Well, you know, Ray, this caused me to think. I noticed this too, going through it quite a bit, and it caused me to think that this basic conflict or distinction between faith-based religion and science is going to end up with the total triumph of science over religion, just like the Copernican theory ended up being
yes.
totally And it just, this is what Hitler has been saying that he's looking forward to. He expects this. But it just hit me with this one. Because, you know, I've always tried to hang on to, you know, the value of Christianity to the Western world and so on, at least,
right.
You know. But really, religion is something that was there before there was any development of scientific thinking. So
sure.
It answered all the questions. But it doesn't answer any questions, really.
No,
think now I'm just seeing that, for me, it's like, well, eventually science is going to take over altogether. Some people are afraid of science. They think it has no humanity or something, or that it's going to be a bunch of white coat people dreaming things up. And there's always that danger in everything. So because there's good people in religion, too. But I just
right.
think that this is the way it's going to go, and it life just keeps reaching a higher level of awareness and learning and understanding of what makes it, what it's made up of. And certainly that's going to leave all the stories of the religious stories and fables and so on far behind, it seems to me.
Sure.
So shall we... Yeah. Shall we go on as we intended, since we're already passed over the line here? We just have a short one here, don't we? And then we have
it's fine with me. We came very close to the one that we wanted to end with. This one is short right here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go ahead. I'll just give a little timeline thing then for the 3rd of June that the British coal industry is nationalized. I guess that's kind of important. That the Battle of Midway opens with ineffective attacks by land-based American B-17s on the approaching Japanese fleet. Oh, but it got started anyway.
Right.
So.
3rd of June, 1942, at dinner. Technological warfare. The elephants of Hannibal. It is astonishing to note to what a degree the ancients succeeded in adapting technology to the needs of war. The victories of Hannibal without his elephants, or of Alexander without his chariots, his cavalry, and the technique of his archers are impossible to conceive. In war, the best soldier, that is to say, the soldier who achieves the greatest success, is the one who has the most modern technical means at his disposal, not only in battle itself, but also in the field of communications and supply. In time of war, to face oneself with the dilemma, shall we have a soldier or a technical expert, is the greatest mistake one can possibly make. A sound strategy, therefore, must be one which succeeds in molding the technical means at its disposal in such a manner as to meet one's needs with the maximum of efficiency.
He said that before, too. He sees the, you know, technical inventions as highly, highly important, and that's what causes today, in today's armies, that's what causes you to win over the enemy, because you've got higher developed armament.
Weaponry. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and so the 4th of, and let me just say now, since I was going to add it at the end, that when I was talking about science winning out over religion, that I was really tying it together with what we talked about, and especially what you said on Monday night when you called into the Heretics Hour, and we got on that. And then this, you know, reading this in here is just like connected with that, and it just became pretty clear to me what I said.
Kind of an affirmation, you know,
at
least for me, you know. So, I appreciate that, and it's a learning thing.
Well, right. It just goes to show, like he was saying, it's hard for people to let go what they're
That's
used
right.
to. Really hard, you
sure.
know. And it takes time. Yeah, everybody's going about it on a different speed, and can happen over centuries, you know. Really. So.
That's right.
Well, the 4th is the Battle of Midway now. The day opens with Japanese attack on the air defenses of the island. And the next thing that happens on the 4th is Reinhard Heydrich dies in Prague.
Yes.
And so now we go to our final segment here.
Okay, 4th of June, 1942, at dinner. Murder in Prague. Heydrich's imprudence and rashness. The Führer comments on the assassination of Heydrich. I shall forthwith give an absolute order that in future our men who are particularly exposed to danger must implicitly obey the regulations laid down to ensure their safety. Since it is the opportunity which makes not only the thief but also the assassin such heroic gestures as driving in an open, unarmored vehicle or walking about the streets of Prague unguarded are just damned stupidity which serves the country not one whit. That a man as irreplaceable as Heydrich should expose himself to unnecessary danger, I can only condemn as stupid and idiotic. Men of importance like Heydrich should know that they are eternally being stalked like game and that there are any number of people just waiting for the chance to kill them. The police alone, with the means of information at their disposal, cannot guarantee security. When a car collides with a tree, for example, it takes them goodness knows how long to decide whether there has, in fact, been any foul play. If a driver is shot and the car crashes, the passengers cannot really know what has happened, for when one is traveling at 60 miles an hour, a bullet reaches its mark long before the sound of its discharge is heard. So long as conditions in our territories remain unstable, and until the German people has been completely purged of the foreign rabble, our public men must exercise the greatest care for their safety. That is in the interest of the nation. It shows the effect the loss of Heydrich had on him.
Well, and it also shows that, you know, he didn't say anything during these dinner time talks, or at least it wasn't written down, because they had thought that he would be recovering. He seemed to be, but they found out that even though he had his spleen removed, but I guess these fibers from that upholstery had gotten into other parts of his body. Anyway, he had such an infection. And here's some interesting things I found out that, you know, according to Wikipedia, after the Czech doctors were working on Heydrich, Himmler ordered another physician from Germany, Karl Gebhardt, to fly to Prague to take charge of the care. And despite a fever, Heydrich's recovery appeared to progress well. Even Theodore Morell, you know, that much maligned personal physician of Adolf Hitler, suggested the use of sulfonamide, you know, sulfur drug, a new antibacterial drug. But Gebhardt, this German doctor, thinking Heydrich would recover, refused to use it. Maybe that would have helped.
Wow.
At least, you know, sometimes it just seems like fate is just working in ways to either bring something about or cause something not to happen, or, you know, bring something bad about. Anyway, on the 2nd of June, Himmler visited Heydrich, and it seems as though Heydrich was reconciled to his fate by reciting a part of one of his father's operas, which is, "The world is just a barrel organ, which the Lord God turns himself. We all have to dance to the tune, which is already on the drum." Well, supposedly that's what Heydrich quoted to, or recited to Himmler while he was there, and he had a sense that it was over for him, or at least he was accepting whatever fate brought about. But let's see. The other thing I wanted to say was that, you know, the Germans had this, when it came to people who were of high level like Heydrich was and who were doing a wonderful job, you don't want to give them orders, you know, saying you must do this and you must do that. Because Himmler had been telling him and urging him not to drive around like he did in the open car and not to go the same time every day and so on. But Heydrich wouldn't listen to him. And Himmler didn't feel like he could order Heydrich, and Hitler didn't either, you know. Hitler didn't like ordering high-level officers and high-level operatives in his government to do things. It brought to mind how in July 1944, the Valkyrie assassination thing took place, and it was because these people like Stauffenberg, who was only a colonel, but people who came to these meetings, these officers, were not searched and were not, you know, subjected to anything like that. They came and went, and they could come into the meeting, these map reading meetings and so on, then they could leave if there was a phone call for them or something and come back again. And that's what Stauffenberg did. Of course, after, and just because Hitler wasn't killed, several other people were killed, you know, and
that's
one
right.
was his aide, one of his aides, Schmunt. And so his security detail, his private bodyguard security detail, SS, was felt very bad. But they did say that they weren't able to install the kind of rules they would have wanted to search everybody all the time. And of course, after it happened, then they set up those rules, and Hitler didn't object. And everybody, for anything, I don't care who you were, you had to be searched before you came in, you know, to the inner part of the compound and so on. But by then, you know, the damage was done. And it made me think, too, of Hitler's relationship with Hans Ulrich Rudel, the great pilot, who he had decided that he thought Hans Rudel was his correct successor and could be the next Führer of Germany. And he tried to get Rudel to give up his flying, and he didn't want to tell him what he had in mind. He said he couldn't say that, so he just told him that he had a very important task, other tasks he wanted him to do. But Rudel didn't want to give up his flying, you know, and he had all this bonding with his group and his men and this and that and the other thing, and he loved going up there and shooting down, you know, all this. And he would tell Hitler, you're not going to ask me to give up what I'm doing, to give up my flying, you know. He just wouldn't do it, and Hitler just looked at him, you know, and just then he'd smile and say, well, you just be careful, you know, we don't want to lose you. But
right.
he knew that he couldn't force him to do what he didn't want to do and have him have a high-level position and do a good job of it. How could he become the next Führer if he was forced to do it against his will, so to speak? So they had this attitude toward of honoring one another, which is so different from what was going on in the Soviet Union, but it caused things not always to. But you can't force people to.
No, and you're not.
You probably have forced Heydrich to quit driving in that car. Open car, you probably could have without upsetting him too much, but somehow it didn't happen.
Yeah, but guys like Rudel and Heydrich were so very effective and good at the jobs they were doing, and, you know, and Hitler knew, or people knew that if they did assume the authority and things like this, that they would be taken out of their natural element. Now, they still would probably do well there, but not near as good as they were doing or serving the nation at what they were doing. And so it was kind of like, well, okay, be careful, you know, just don't get lost.
Yeah.
So a
but
resignation,
you know,
to let those guys.
Hitler saw the bigger picture, but he didn't see it when it came to allowing these officers to come and go in the inner compound, and he thought, you know, we were all honorable men, and he didn't want to treat officers like they were under suspicion.
Under suspicion, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's been I've really enjoyed this session, and I appreciate folks sticking with us, and, once again, reminding you that we will be with you on the evening of New Year's Day, Thursday, January the 1st, as we resume our study. And I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a good holiday season with friends and family.
Same for me. And thank you for listening to this show on the 11th of December, the Hitler's Table Talk.